Blog Talk Radio.
Once again, we are up to lesson 64 in our study of the Book of Acts. This is your host, Andy Young, and I want to thank you once again for joining us on Blog Talk Radio for another Tuesday night Bible study. And yes, I know it's been a couple weeks since our last lesson. Man, I have been busy with all kinds of things, editing videos from the Hank Conference, working extra hours in the evening. So there have been various things, fortunately, that have gotten in the way, life in the way sometimes, that have kept me from being able to bring a lesson here in the Book of Acts. I'm trying to get through this. We're coming down to the end, and I want to get through this here, but we're going to do our best back tonight. Hopefully, we'll get on our regular schedule of being here every Tuesday night from this point forward. Again, if life doesn't get in the way. Who knows? You know, things happen like that sometimes. The phone number, if you'd like to be a part of the program, is area code 347-855-8317. That's area code 347-855-8317. If you have a Skype account, go ahead and click on the Skype button that you see on the program screen. And actually, now that I say that, I understand that there have been some people who have had some technical issues trying to log into program using that Skype button. But you can still use your Skype account rather than clicking on that button. Just dial in using the program number, the 347-855-8317. Just dial in using Skype. Dial in using that number. If you have technical difficulties with the Skype button itself. The email, if you'd like to send comments or questions, is mail@ttank.com. That's mail@ttank.com. And you can always make comments on the program screen as usual. Just scroll down to the bottom of the program screen. You'll see the spot where you can enter comments there. I'm going to tell you something up front here. Oh, before we get started, go ahead and take your Bibles. We are in Acts chapter 27. Acts chapter 27, you can be turning there while I go on with our introduction here. I'm going to tell you something up front. I had the hardest time with this lesson. I probably started and stopped over half a dozen times while trying to prepare for this lesson. And it has to do with an observation I've already made a few times already. You've heard me say this in previous lessons, that these last few chapters of Acts are very heavy on narrative and light on theology, struggling with trying to make the lessons relevant. See, in my mind, I've got this mindset, and I'm sure this has to do with growing up in the institutional church. We've got this mindset that if this is going to be a Bible study, it ought to have some theological relevance to it, right? Don't you think? So if you've got a passage of Scripture like we do here in Acts 27, where there isn't a lot of theology being taught, how do you make it theologically relevant? And this is where I think we fall into the trap and the error of making assumptions about interpretation. This is where we start to stray. We start to stray away from exegesis into eisegesis. And this is the error in the Reformed hermeneutic, is they will take passages like this, and they do what? They try to find Christ in every verse passage. In other words, making application with the passage that was never intended. Never intended. And like I fall into this same trap, and I found myself doing this in trying to prepare this one. And I think we are so conditioned to having this mindset from all our years in the institutional church, that because something is in the Bible, there's got to be some deep theological relevance to it. And I don't necessarily think that that's the case in all passages. But I recognize now that this is actually a whole way of interpreting the Bible itself. When we do this by trying to read it in its gospel context. Now, so I'm trying to prepare this lesson, and I'm struggling with this, and I finally realize that I'm attempting to do something this chapter the Reformed are guilty of. And so I stop, and I wait. Why does it have to be this way? Why does there have to be some theological relevance and recognize that the words just say what they say and nothing more? Why does something recorded in the Bible have to be more than just informative? And you know, it doesn't. And when we remember who Acts was written, when we remember that this was first and foremost a historical account from Luke to Theophilus, a matter of historical record. Luke wasn't sending any hidden messages to Theophilus. That was not his purpose. Luke wasn't trying to teach Theophilus any kind of doctrine or theology. He says much in his introduction. If you go all the way back to the opening verses of chapter 1, this was a historical account. Luke was setting the record. He was establishing the record. My lesson is different from other lessons we've had on Acts. In fact, I usually script out my lessons, and I end up with about 6 to 7 pages of notes so that I can keep my idea in a logical order. And I haven't done that tonight. With the exception of the introduction here, I've probably got maybe 3-4 pages at most of notes, of talking points, as it were. You know, so what I want to do tonight is I just want to go through, maybe we'll go through a paragraph at a time, and then we'll stop, and I'll have a few of these talking points, which I'll offer as commentary on that paragraph. I'm not going to pull out any theological significance, but what we'll do is examine some of the specifics of what's going on in this narrative. And we'll get into the Greek text some, and we'll compare this alongside the cultural context of the time. And I think that we will get a lot out of this. Maybe not theologically, maybe not a lot of doctrine per se, but it will open our understanding a little bit more of just what's happening at this point in the narrative, and make it a little bit more real to us. And if you want to go ahead and make your applications, you feel free to do that. But I'm not going to stand here as any kind of authority and say dogmatically that this is what you should interpret this to mean. Okay? This particular episode that happens here is indicative of how we should do this in our Christian life. That's eisegesis. I'm not going to do that. I'm going to do my best to stay away from that because I don't fall that same trap as error. So let's get into it. We're going to get about half of chapter 27 tonight, but I want to just jump back a few verses. Actually, start with verse 30 of chapter 26, and this will be a lead-in to where we are. You'll remember that Paul has given this wonderful testimony about Jesus before King Agrippa. And he's all these references to the prophets. And the whole reason why Agrippa is there is because it is understood that he is an expert in all Jewish laws and customs and traditions. And Paul plays to this, knowing that this is the case. And it all comes to a climax. It all builds to this one point at the beginning of chapter 26, where Paul is on the spot, and he asks him straight out, "Do you believe Moses and the prophets? I know you do. Agrippa, you know what I say is true." Agrippa can respond, "No way." But almost in resignation, he says, "You know, Paul, you make a good case. You have persuaded." Almost. Just couldn't go that extra step to believe, where he couldn't commit to belief in Jesus as Messiah. And we speculated as to the reasons for that. And we saw so much, you know, we saw the parallel there between that and what happens in the institutional church among many theologians when you present to them the argument and you show them the truth and they just don't want to accept it. Can't acknowledge it because they have so much invested and wrapped up with what they have right now. So after all is said and done, we come to verse 30 in Acts chapter 26. Just go back, let your eyes go up there a couple of verses. Follow along with me as I read. Acts chapter 26, verse 30. The king, the governor, and Bernice rose up and those that with them. And having abide, they spoke to one another, saying, "This man does nothing worthy of death or of bonds." Agrippa said to Festus, "This man is able to have been let go if he had not appealed unto Caesar." And here we have knowledge once again that Paul hasn't committed any crimes. This is where the significance of Roman citizenship is important, accusing him of treason. But they can't find the acts of treason. They accuse him of defiling the temple. And the Jews were allowed to punish their own people for this. Now, King Agrippa, being the expert, even acknowledges that Paul didn't defile the temple in any way. The Jews accused him of speaking evil of Moses' law. But again, Agrippa, the expert, acknowledges that no. What Paul teaches is perfectly consistent with Moses and the prophets. He showed him that, okay, in his testimony. And so, ironically, Paul should have been freed. But once an appeal is made to Caesar, by law, it had to be carried out. No longer under the local jurisdiction that appeal is made. And we talked about this. Being accused of treason, one of the rights afforded to a Roman citizen was that you were accused of treason, you could take your appeal directly to Caesar. This was a right as a Roman citizen. And here again, we see why Paul's Roman citizenship was stressed so much in these previous chapters. So, because he's appealed to Caesar, it is no longer on. So even if he wanted to Paul, he couldn't. Because now the jurisdiction is on Caesar. Only Caesar can be at this point. So that brings us to chapter 27 and the bulk of the text for tonight. So let's just start working our way through here with this first paragraph. some comments and wait to the end, open things up for some discussion, comments of your own. We'll have Paul and Susan with us, we sail in Italy. Notice that there, Luke is writing first person plural. Luke is with them. Luke is accompanying Paul on this journey. So Luke is writing from his own perspective. He's going through this with Paul. When it was determined that we should sail into Italy, they delivered Paul and certain other prisoners under the name Julius, a centurion of Augustus' band. And entering in the ship of Adimitrium, we launched, meaning to sail by the coast of Asia. One Aristarchus, a Macedonian of Thessalonica, with us. And the next day, we touched at Sidon, Paul, and gave him liberty to go unto his friends to refresh himself. All right, let's stop here. What can we say about this? Most of what we read is simply to detail the route they took. We have the name of the ship. We understand that the reason they're taking the route that they did is because there's this man named Aristarchus from Macedonia who's with them. Perhaps he's the one that chartered the ship. He wants to go to Sidon. We can follow the route, and having these details like this to follow the route is going to come to play later on, as we'll see. Now, I want to note Paul's treatment here. We are given the name of a centurion named Julius. Julius. Specifically, he was of the Augustus band. Now, we've got your Roman military, like our own modern military, divided into divisions and Italian brigades and companies and platoons and squads and so forth. So a centurion is obviously one who is in charge of 100 men. One, and they're all encapsulated in this larger division called the Augustus Band. Now, I find it interesting that Luke takes time. Luke takes the time to identify the centurion by name. I think it's significant because that doesn't happen often. There's only three times, I think, where we've read in the book of Acts where a Roman soldier has been identified by name. Remember in Acts chapter 10, there was Cornelius and his household coming to belief in Jesus Christ. The first Gentiles that we see, a large group of Gentiles coming to believe in Jesus Christ. And then Paul was first captured, arrested, while returned to Jerusalem. We're told of this chief captain named Claudius Lysias. So I think it's significant, we've got the Roman soldiers identified by name. If the book of Acts is being written to Theophilus, the matter of historical record, the fact that these Roman soldiers are identified by name is going to play some importance. What that is, I have no idea. But it obviously meant something to Theophilus, and it obviously was important for Luke to take the time to identify them specifically. Once again, we see Paul's Roman citizenship in importance. Not only was Julius identified specifically as being the centurion in charge of Paul, we're told that Paul received very good treatment at the hands of Julius. It says he was courteously treated. The word courteously or philanthropos. Philanthropos, of course, we get the word philanthropy from this. Literally means showing love to mankind, or showing love to man, or showing kindness to man. It means humane. Julius showed fondness towards Paul. He treated him humanely. He treated him as a person. He treated him as a fellow Roman citizen who was due all the rights that belonged to him as a Roman citizen. And then that word and treated is this word kreomai. And it has the idea of furnishing what is needed. So when it says that Julius courteously entreated Paul, not only did he treat Paul fairly as a citizen, but he provided Paul the things that he needed. And what was it that Paul needed? We're told specifically he was given liberty to go unto his friends to refresh himself. And the phrase in itself is kind of interesting. What it literally means is that Julius, the Roman centurion, turned over custody of Paul over to Paul's friends. There's an awful lot of amount of trust that's afforded there, not only to Paul, but also to his friends. He entrusted the charge of Paul to his friends. I think that says a lot about the character of a centurion. Recognized Paul was one who could be trusted. Paul was one who would, if he was told to be at a certain place, he would be there. He was not going to try to run. I don't even think it's unreasonable to assume that Julius may have even been present at some of Paul's Some of the times when Paul gave testimony, whether it be before Festus or whether it be before Agrippa, it's possible that this centurion Julius was present when Paul gave his testimony. So he literally turned Paul over to the custody of his friends so that he could refresh himself. How did he refresh himself? Just simply enjoying their hospitality. They would provide Paul meals, a place to sleep, fellowship, encouraging, all the things happen between like-minded brothers and sisters in Christ when they gather together for fellowship, mutual edification. So this is the kind of thing that's happening here at Sidon on this first stop of the journey. So let's go on and look at the next paragraph. And we're looking at verse 4. Verse 4. And when he had launched from thence, so they've left Sidon now, right? When we had launched from thence, we sailed under Cyprus because the winds were contrary. And when we had sailed over the sea of Cilicia, Pamphylia, into Myra, a city of Cilicia. And there, the centurion found the ship of Alexandria sailing into Italy and put us there. Let me stop here for a second. I want to just, a ship of Alexandria, most likely what that means is this was a ship that had come from Alexandria, Egypt. Alexandria was a large port. And in some cases, some of these cargo ships were so large, some of these merchant ships were so large that Alexandria was the only port that could handle them. So when we say a ship of Alexandria, this was probably a cargo ship that had come from Alexandria, was either dropping off goods or picking them up and was going to continue on to its next stop in Italy. So Judas the centurion puts Paul onto this cargo ship, this merchant ship that's come from Alexandria. Verse 7. And when he had sailed and when we had sailed slowly many days, and scarce were come over, and I'm going to say this is pronounced Sindus or Sidus, however, the winds not suffering us or not allowing us, we sailed under Crete over against Simone, and hardly passing, we came unto a place which is called the Fair Havens, nigh whereunto was the city of Lasea. So again, we're recording the route here. Luke is recording the route he took. He's telling us that the winds were contrary. Notice that this voyage, from the time they left Sidon, is taking them longer than they had anticipated. The winds were not favorable. They're trying to go to Sinai in the right direction. So they have to go a different direction. So they go down, they sail down between the islands of Crete and Salome. And they is hardly passing it. In other words, they had a time getting through there. They finally end up at this place called the Fair Havens, which literally means good ports or good harbors. Good harbors. And there's a city called Lasea. Now, time is critical here. Time is critical here because this has a bearing on the next paragraph that we're going to read. Keep this in mind. This cargo ship. This is a merchant ship. And actually, if you look on your program screen, on your slideshow there, I've actually included a graphic, a drawing of what one of these merchant ships might have looked like from the first century. This is a sample of a Roman merchant ship. This is a mid-sized merchant ship. Notice how it's constructed. Okay, this is not a warship, right? Warships are built for speed. Warships are long, sleek, and slender, so they can cut through the water quickly. They break through any large waves. Nothing slows them down. Okay. Cargo ships, on the other hand, are built for tonnage. And you can see that in this picture. It's round and it's bulky. It can hold a lot of stuff. Consequently, its shape and its design doesn't make for well handling in rough seas. Not going to do very well in rough seas. In fact, it's going to travel more slowly. And again, time is critical here. And we're going to see reference in the next paragraph to the fast. And what that is, the word we're referring to this fast is actually the fast that follows the Day of Atonement. This is Yom Kippur. We just recognized this here just a couple weeks ago, in the middle of the seventh month in the Jewish calendar. That would be the equivalent to September for us. Okay, middle of September was the Day of Atonement, and then you have the fast. Now we're going to look at the fast was already passed. Now we're getting into October. So this is middle of the fall. Going into the middle of September, going into October. All right, you with me here? And time is critical. Now look what happens. Let's go on to verse 9. It indicates the time of year. It's late, it's middle, early to middle fall. It's dangerous for them to sail at this point. Paul admonishes them and says to them, "Sirs, I perceive that this voyage will be with much hurt and much damage, not only of the lading of the ship, but also of our lives." Nevertheless, the centurion believed the master and owner of the ship more than those things which were spoken by Paul. And because the haven was not commodious within, the more part advised to depart thence also, if by any means they might attain to Phenice, and there to winter, or maybe that's pronounced Phoenix, and there to winter. Phoenix is a haven of Crete, and lies to south and west. Okay, Phoenix is another haven or another harbor on the island of Crete, but it's a little bit different location. A little bit more favorable location for them. Now, look at what Paul says here. This is important. Paul says, I perceive. What Paul saying here? Is Paul getting instructions from God? Is Paul telling the man complaint received from God? No. What is he doing here? Paul is using his own experience, his own reasoning, his own volition here. He's saying, I perceive. In other words, it is my opinion, based on experience and based on what I know, that it's not a good thing for us to leave at this point. To sail at this point, there's going to be a lot of loss. That's important. Okay? Paul has come to this conclusion on his own. He is expressing his observations to the men of the ship. Notice also, makes a choice here. The centurion listens to Paul, and he listens to the captain of the ship, the owner of the ship, the men on board, the crew, perhaps the owner of the cargo is traveling on the ship as well. All of these men want to go. They're aware of the danger, but they have other pressing matters. I'm sure that there's time issues at stake. I'm sure there's monetary issues at stake. Maybe perhaps deadlines to try and meet. And so these men on the ship have a pressing need to want to leave now despite the danger. And so this puts the centurion in a very difficult situation where he's now got to either listen. He's under a lot of pressure to make a choice. Either listen to Paul says or give in to the pressure coming from the ship captain and the crew. And of course, the centurion gives in to the pressure and therefore makes the decision to leave. But notice, the centurion that makes the decision. The centurion makes a choice here. And with his choice become consequences. And we will see that. Now, there are mitigating circumstances here as to why these men want to leave. We've already mentioned a few of them. There probably were schedules, timetables to keep. But also notice that they're told that Fair Havens is not commodious. What does that mean? Does that mean that perhaps because of its location, the winds there were rough? This is a tropical climate. Okay, we're not going to be dealing with things like snow and cold temperatures. You know, so we are in a relatively close to a tropical climate here. But is there something about its location being on the southern side of Crete where the weather, whether it's rainy or gloomy or stormy, perhaps the accommodations are not good? There's not enough to eat there. There's not the kind of inn that they want to stay in. There's not the kind of facilities that they need to service the ship. Whatever they are, we're just told the accommodations there were not their liking. There was something about Fair Havens. They want want to spend the whole week. Let's go to Phoenix. That would be a much better place for us to spend the winter. So they decide to move on to Phoenix. All right. He gives in, get back the boat, and they leave the port of Fair Havens. Now let's move on in verse 13. And when the south wind blew softly, supposing that they had obtained their purpose, loosing thence, they sailed close to Crete. Okay, so they're trying to understand what's happening here. They're trying to sail close to the coast of Crete, westward. You've got a south wind coming up, and that's going to be a favorable wind because actually a ship actually sails fastest going across the wind. The sails of the ship actually act like the wing of an airplane. And so if you're going perpendicular to the direction of the wind is blowing, that is actually, you're going to get most speed out of a sailing ship if you're going perpendicular to the wind. And that's what they're doing. So they have this south wind, which is exactly what they want. They should be able to get really good speed. And they're going to stay right close to the coast of Crete. But look what happens. Verse 14. But not long after, there arose against it a tempestuous wind called Euroclydon. And when the ship was caught, could not bear up into the wind, we let her drive. And running under, another way to interpret that would be sailing past. Okay? Sailing past a certain island, which is called Claudia, we had much work to come by the boat, which when they had taken up, they used hats undergirding the ship, and fearing lest they should fall into the quicksands, strake sail, and so driven. There's a lot going on here. Let's look at this. A tempestuous wind came up. A tempestuous wind. The word here for tempestuous is Greek word tuphonikos. Tuphonikos. That is a compound word. It literally means, now listen to this, it literally means a cloud that conquers. You hear the word niko in there? That means conquer. Tuphonikos, a cloud that conquers. We have a word we get from this. It's called typhoon. Typhoon. Those are tropical storms. You know, actually, National Weather Service calls tropical storms that occur in the Pacific Ocean are referred to as typhoons. In the Atlantic Ocean, we call them hurricanes. Okay? You understand what kind of storm we're dealing with here? This is a hurricane. And much like we name our hurricanes, the Roman culture had a name for this kind of a storm. They call it a Euroclydon. Euroclydon. That's another compound word. We have the word Euros, which refers to an east wind, and the word Pluton, which refers to the surge of the sea. The surge of the sea. Now, does that not describe a hurricane? I don't know if any of you have ever been in a hurricane. I never have. But some of us can remember Hurricane Katrina back in 2006. Hurricane that hit the Gulf Coast of the United States. Specifically hitting New Orleans, Louisiana. And what did most damage to the city of New Orleans was not necessarily the wind or the rain itself, but the storm surge. The huge surging waves that surged against the coast broke the levees that protect the city from the Gulf of Mexico, New Orleans. So this word Euroclydon describes this kind of a storm, an east blowing wind that creates a huge storm surge. So picture this. Now, and here's a guy in the middle in his boat, this little cargo, this little merchant boat. Huge waves, tempestuous winds, gale force winds blowing them every which way. Let's look at what happens here. If you can look at this, I gave you a map. I want to tell you something here because this is interesting. You look at this map that I included in the slideshow. Okay, it has, there you can see the route that Paul and his boat has taken. And there you see the island of Crete, and there is the Fair Havens. You can see where they took off from Fair Havens. Now look at this. A hurricane, this kind of storm, is associated with extreme low pressure system. Pressure system rotate counterclockwise, and you can see that there. So what I've overlaid on this map here is this low pressure system with winds rotating around it in a counterclockwise direction. Now let's understand what's happening here. If you look at the right side of that low pressure system, which direction do the winds blow on the right side of that? They're blowing up from the south, aren't they? And so remember, the captain of the ship and the centurion and everyone on that boat, they said, oh, we've got southern winds coming up. That's just the kind of wind we need. Little did they know, it was the southern wind from this hurricane that was about to hit them. And they start to sail west along the coast. As they get further into the system, now the winds are blowing what direction? They're blowing out of the east. They're blowing out of the east. And so now they're in this Euroclydon, this easterly blowing wind with this huge storm surge. Do you see that happening there? Okay. It says they were unable to bear up. What's it doing? It's pushing them east. It's probably pushing them past Phoenix. Okay. They know where they are. They know where they want to go. But the east wind is taking them farther than what they want to go. So they try to turn the boat around. Now they're sailing back into the wind. And what happens? They were able to bear up. They could not sail into the wind. It was too strong. It was too strong for them to sail back into those winds to get back to Phoenix. So what did they do? It says they struck sail and they just let the storm surge take them where it wanted to go. Okay, they turned the boat around. Actually, what does it say specifically? They could not bear into the wind, so they let her drive, didn't they? They didn't strike the sail yet. They let her drive. They turned her around and said, well, we better go with the wind. So now they've got the winds blowing them. And now look what happens. Once they decide to start sailing with this wind, they have to take some action here. They have to take some action. It says they had to work hard to come by boat. They had to work hard to come by the boat. Now, what does that mean? Well, first of all, that word boat is the Greek word skaphe. The word skaphe refers to a skiff or a dinghy. So this is not a reference to the cargo ship itself. This is a reference to the skiff or the cargo from the ship to land. It happened to pull into port that's too small to accommodate their ship. Okay? So they're going to be towing this dinghy along with them, aren't they? They're going to be towing it along with them. So when they decide to turn the ship around and go with the storm, the first thing they decide to do is they need to secure that dinghy. Why do you think they need to secure the dinghy? if they're being tossed around in this tempestuous sea with these huge waves, probably don't want that dinghy getting tossed around and slamming into the ship. So the first thing that they do is secure a dinghy. It says that they had to work through that. The other thing it says that they did is they used helps to undergird the ship. Now, this is interesting. Now, what are helps? What are helps? The word helps there in the Greek is the word boyesia. Boyesia. Boyesia refers to a rope or a chain for wrapping a vessel. Wrapping a vessel. What does wrapping mean? Well, this is interesting. To wrap a ship, what they would do is they would take these ropes or these chains, and they would go from one side of the ship, and they would run these ropes or chains from, they drop them on one side, underneath the hull of the ship, up to the other side. And they wrap these ropes and chains all along the hull. And what does that do? That reinforces the chains and ropes underneath the ship to keep the hull firm and secure in this storm. I don't know how they did that. I can imagine that I'm trying to do this in storm, running ropes and chains underneath the ship somehow to secure it. Okay? But that's what they did. I thought that was interesting. Next paragraph. Verse 18. And we, being exceedingly tossed with a great tempest, the next day they lighted the ship. And the third day we cast with our own hands the tackling of the ship. And when neither sun nor stars in many days appeared, and no small tempest lay on us, all hope that we should be saved was then taken away. But after long absence, Paul stood forth in the midst of them and said, Sirs, ye should have hearkened unto me, and have not loosed from Crete, and have gained this harm and loss. Now I exhort you to be of good cheer, for there shall be no loss of any man's life among you, but the ship. For there stood by me this night the angel of God, whose I am, and whom I serve, saying, Fear not, Paul, thou must be brought to serve. And lo, God hath given me all in this way. Wherefore, sir, be of good cheer, for I believe God that shall be even as he has told me. Howbeit, we must be cast upon us an island. All right, the ship with these ropes and chains to secure the hull, to reinforce the hull, to hold the boat together, to hold it together. What else did they do? They lighted the ship. They lighted the ship. Now, there's one other thing I want to notice, I want to point out here before I go on. And I meant to say this before. Go back to that map. Go back to that map that I was referring to. All right, look at where they are. They're in this Euroclydon. They're in this hurricane. In the northern part of this low pressure system, where the winds are blowing out of the east. Now, what happens is, here's what happened. As they can, they're letting the storm take the ship, right? They turn the boat around. Now they're sailing with the winds. As they continue in this storm, as they move through the storm, the winds are at a turn and start blowing towards the south, aren't they? And look what is towards the south. They realize, as the storm is taking the boat, is taking the ship, they're now going south. They're going away from where they intended to go. They're going away from Crete. And they said, hey, if we continue to go south, we're going to head into quicksands. Do you see that? On the map there, it says the quicksands, Syrtis Major. Those are actually a series of shoals in the cove of northern Africa. There were some shoals there and some what are they called? Not reefs, but sandbars. Quicksand. So that is the reference when it says that they were worried about falling into the quicksands. They were afraid of the wind driving them so far south that they'd end up on the northern coast of Africa in this area called the quicksands. They were afraid of being blown that course. And so what they did instead at that point is lowered the sails. And then they just left the boat to the sea of the currents, wherever the currents would take, hoping that somehow they would ride this storm and stay relatively in one place. But what happens with a hurricane is it usually follows a storm track. And because of the Earth rotation, remember Earth is rotating from west to east, okay? Because of the rotation of the Earth, storms like hurricanes will genuinely track in a westward direction. And so that is exactly what's happening with these men. They're caught in the storm day and around and around and around and around in this hurricane, gradually tracking westward. And what we see would be where they eventually end up the island of Melita. Do you understand what's happening here as caught in this storm? And they're in for days and days, it says. So much to the point that they actually gave up hope. They were going to die there. Now, what did they do? They lighted the ship. They threw out all the cargo, all the stuff that was of value to them, this valuable cargo, grain, wine, olive oil, who knows what else. Why did they do that? Well, to lighten the ship, if you're going to lighten the ship, that means it's going to ride higher in the water. Why would we want our ship to ride higher in water? Obviously, so that it doesn't hit anything underneath. They don't know where they're going. They don't know where this storm is taking them. They don't know what they could crash into. Just heading towards these quicksands, they don't want to hit any shoals. So they wanted the ship to ride as high as it could. What else did they do? It says they threw out the tackling. That's an interesting word. They threw out the tackling. The word there for tackling is the word skua. Skua. And it refers to the gear of the ship. So that would be the sails, the rigging, instruments, any spare furnishings, okay? The equipment needed for the proper functioning of a ship. Okay? That's important. The equipment needed for the proper functioning of a ship. Now, why do I point this out? Because this word skua comes from the same word that is used in 1 Peter. You could turn to 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 7 if you want to, but I'll read it to you. Okay? 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 7 says, likewise, husbands, dwell with them according to knowledge, giving honor unto the wife as to the weaker vessel, and as being heirs together of the grace of life, your prayer be not hindered. Now that word vessel is from the same root word as skua. In this context, Peter is saying that the wife is a vessel. He's comparing her to the equipment needed for the proper functioning of a ship. There's a parallel here. Okay? He's saying that the wife performs a function in aiding the husband, in helping him in the proper functioning of the household. The issue arises here with the word that's the word weaker. So the idea is that the wife is somehow inferior to the husband. But that's not at all what Peter is saying in this context. Okay, I want you to understand this. The word there for weaker is better understood as without strength or strengthless. And it is used here specifically in a spiritual sense. In a spiritual sense, this has to do with spiritual knowledge and power, spiritual understanding. So you put this together, and what Peter is saying in verse 7 of 1 Peter chapter 3, wives are so important to the husband to help him function properly. She is a vessel. She is a channel through which he's made useful. She is as important to the husband as all of these furnishings are to the proper functioning of a sailorship. Okay? She is contributing to the husband's usefulness in his duties as a husband. So the husband, in turn, needs to see to the wife's spiritual well-being. He needs to be strengthening her spiritually, guiding her in knowledge, equipping her so that she, in turn, can equip him. And I think that is a beautiful illustration of just how a husband and wife are supposed to function together as one. So I just threw in there that little aside, just how, you know, when we study scripture, we look for these words and we see where else they're used. It gives us insight to the meanings of the words when we see how they're used in other places. The context gives us the definition. Get back to our narrative. They're caught in this storm for a while. The storm track is taking them west direction. And notice that all this time, Paul has been keeping his mouth. Notice that? But finally, he gets caught. I told you so. I told you so. Now, if there is any doctrine to be found anywhere in this passage, it's going to be here. This is probably the only part in this narrative where we could probably pull any kind of doctrinal application. Paul says, my statement is, I told you so. So what? Yeah, I told you not to go, but finally have something to tell you. He says, I exhort you. And this is not the usual word that is translated exhort. This is a different word. And the word here that's used in the Greek basically means, I advise you to take a different course of action. I advise you to take a different course of action. Now, what was the course of action that they had taken to up to this point? Okay. Not the fact that they didn't listen to Paul's advice. There's no sense in rehashing what's past. You can't do anything about the choice you made back then. We're here. What are we going to deal with now? Deal with what we can deal with now. So he says, what are you doing right now? They've been out here for days. They think all hope is lost. All hope is lost. We're going to die here. The men are in despair. Paul says, stop despair. Stop your hopelessness. I advise you to take a different course of action versus hope. Hope. How can you have hope in Satan? How do I know that we don't need to despair? How do I know this? Paul says, because God's messenger spoke to me. We don't see that God has spoken to Paul until just this night now. Days and days and days have passed. Finally, God speaks to Paul. He sends an angel. And the word for angel is the word angelos. It means messenger. God sends a messenger to Paul. And the angel says, don't worry. Don't despair. There's hope. And more than that, Paul says, this is a messenger from God. And guess what? He says, a messenger from God, who I am. I belong to God. I am God's child. He's my father. He sent me a messenger, and he gave a message of hope. Here is this message of hope. I advise you now. You didn't listen to me before. Listen to me now. Take a different course of action. Stop your despair. Listen to my message of hope. Because God said, it's necessary for me to go to Caesar. For Caesar. Because I have to go before Caesar, that means we're going to get there. We're going to get there. Notice, we're going to get there. Notice that God did not say that it was his will for us to go through this hurricane. Did he say that? All he said was, Paul, it's necessary for you to appear before Caesar. Now, it probably would have been better if they had not gone through the hurricane. You know, think about this. If the men had listened to Paul and not left Crete when they wanted to, if they would have stayed where they were, they wouldn't have gone through the hurricane. And they still have gotten to Italy. They still would have gotten to Caesar. Wouldn't they? Okay? But God did not determine the hurricane. God did not determine them to go through the hurricane. They went through the hurricane because the centurion made a poor choice, didn't he? Okay? Now, all through this, we see men making choices. What are we trying to say here? Being here on this day, on this day when he messenger. Does God intervene? Is this God exhibiting his foreknowledge somehow? I don't know that I have the answer to this. But clearly we see men making choices and suffering from the consequences of their choices. And clearly now we see God stepping into the picture, giving Paul a message of hope for these men, saying, don't despair. We're going to get to Rome. Not only that, all are going to get there alive. So cheer up, because I believe God. I believe God. He's my father. I believe him. He told me that it's necessary for me to go to Rome to appear before Caesar. I believe him. So because I believe him, you guys can cheer up. We're going to get out of this. You made some bad choices. You didn't listen to me. But you know what? We're going to get out of this. I think that's a tremendously encouraging message. And Paul says, you know what? We're going to be cast upon this certain island, Melita. And, of course, you can see the storm track is taking that way in the direction. And that is where we're going to wrap this lesson for tonight. Next week, we'll look at the rest of chapter 27. And we'll see what happens on the rest, we'll follow Paul and company the rest of this hurricane. And we'll see what happens when they wash up on the island of Melita and everything that happens there. We'll go ahead and go to take some phone calls. Some questions, comments. Again, if you'd like to be a part of the show tonight, the phone number is area code 347 855-8317. You can email us at mail@ttn.com. That's mail@ttank.com. You can feel free to leave questions or comments on the program screen below. I thought Paul and Susan had been waiting on hold with us, but they dropped off for some reason. Hopefully they're listening in and are trying to call in back to the program now as we speak. I can keep vamping here until they come back online or, oh, here we go. I think this is them now. Somebody just popped up. So let me go to the phone and bring the call online. And I believe it is Paul and Susan that are with us. Hello, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. Okay, well, there was an interesting lesson. There's offered opportunity to learn a little bit about shipping and how ships work, which is always interesting. I guess I don't have very many comments tonight. As he said, it's mostly narrative, although, you know, there are still opportunities in there. You know, I've often found and I'm wondering, you know, the Book of Acts is narrative, and a lot of narrative, and therefore historical narrative, and therefore difficult to teach through, unless you kind of do it like you did tonight, taking the opportunity to teach about culture and whatnot, which is, you know, very helpful. But I find myself, especially in what I've been studying lately, in the Book of Romans, especially in the Book of Romans and some things, as you know, I've been doing some study on covenants and whatnot. I found Acts and the events that happened in Acts to be very helpful in explaining, you know, how should I put this? Especially in regard to covenants, Acts seems to be the actual historical event or recording of how, you know, the covenants played out, especially the new covenant, you know. That's the importance of the Book of Acts. It's the actual, you know, functioning of the covenants. You know, the Romans and some other books, Galatians and Romans, are kind of how the covenants work, and the Book of Acts seems to be the actual historical recording of how it did work and how it played out. I had that observation. And then I thought the observation that you made about it being God's will that they went through the storm, well, they, you know, God certainly, and, you know, as you mentioned before, the temptation is, you know, eisegetically, is to take the whole thing about the storm and teach how God tests our faith, you know. How God, it's God's will to put us through these trials to test our faith, you know. Well, you know, don't use that passage for that. They were in the storm because of bad choices. Now, I don't know how Paul knew that it was a bad idea to sail that in that direction or whatever. He said that he perceived it. You know, I don't know how he would do that. You know, what information he had. It was perceptive. So I'm assuming that it's kind of like, you know, maybe we shouldn't take off from the airport because there's, you know, obviously a bad storm over in that direction. I don't know if it was any of that or not. Something like that, you know, objective like that. I don't know. But at any rate, however you want to cut it, they were in the storm to begin with because of bad choices. You know?
Right. Exactly.
So even though it's not God's will, obviously, to make, you know, bad choices, obviously, he chooses to intervene to bail us out from time to time for more necessary
yep.
purposes, I suppose.
Right.
So, you know, yeah. That's all interesting, and, you know, the great thing about the Bible is, and you wonder sometimes why it has all of these narratives, especially in the Old Testament, I think that is, you know, to in large part to show us how life works,
mm-hmm.
you know, especially Old Testament.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if you read a lot of the Old Testament casually, okay, in your daily reading, a lot of theology in our day just doesn't add up or make any kind of sense at all.
Mm-hmm.
So those would be, you know, my input tonight. That's all I have.
Okay.
Other than it was a little choppy tonight, but you could follow it.
Okay.
Next week, I would just go ahead and use the hotspot, the 4G hotspot.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right.
In fact, we got extra data now for that purpose. So.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Can't understand why it's so choppy, because like I said, I've got 8 meg internet speed here, you know, where I'm at, even out in this rural location, you know, we've got 8 megs, and, you know, I just checked the speed on it before I logged on this morning tonight, and it was going strong. So I don't know if it's that or if it's thing works somewhere that's making it choppy, or that might be something to consider
here
for next week.
Yeah, I can tell you out here in Dayton, I can't do the radio program from out here in Dayton at all. You know, so it
mm-hmm.
may be more where I'm at, but of course I'm experiencing kind of the same thing. But at any rate, even though it was choppy, you could follow it. You could follow it.
Okay. Well, good.
You know.
Good.
Yeah. You could follow
all right.
it. But next week you might want to consider just using the tethering or whatever, however you pronounce that, and teethering or tethering or whatever it is.
Right.
And because... you know, we got the G's. We got extra G's for that purpose. So,
how are things going there? Is Susan with you tonight?
She isn't. She's in Xenia, and I don't know whether she listened or not. Okay.
Okay.
And, of course, out, you know, so I don't know. I haven't heard from her since early this afternoon. So, that I don't know if she listened in or not. So, but again, you know, you could follow it. It was choppy here and there, but for the most part, mm-hmm. you could follow it well enough. So I think we're good.
Yeah. Like I said, I had such a hard time trying to get this lesson ready, because it's just a matter of, you know, where do I go with this? I'm reading through it, and I'm trying to, you know, I'm trying to follow along, you know, go verse by verse. And I'm just like, there's nothing here. Where do I go with this? There's very little doctrine in this. It's just, okay, there it is, you know. The temptation is so great just to fall into that. How can we apply this? How can we apply that? And when we start doing that, you know, it's just a matter of now it comes down to individual interpretation. And it's just like I can't do that. I'm not going to go there with it. I decided the best thing to do was just look. Here's what it says. You know, we can do a historical cultural comparison here, and maybe gain a few tidbits of information right there that would help us understand more of what was going on. Get a picture, and I hope what I was able to do tonight kind of gave a little bit better picture as we follow the story as it's being told. Just to kind of expand the story a little bit. And so it's like, oh, okay, I understand why it says this. Oh, I see where they're going. I see what's happening. That's kind of what I...
Yeah. Because
that's what I was discovering myself. As I was, you know, as I was looking into some of the expressions, these words, what does it mean that it's really talking about? But, oh, I get it. I understand. That's what... Oh, okay, that's why they were here. That's why this... That's why it took them. I understand.
Yeah.
You know, so little things like that.
Yeah.
When I was discovering, I was hoping to... perhaps being able to pass on in the lesson.
Yeah, I think there's always opportunity to do that, to take opportunity to see how words are used in context and how that can help us in other passages. You know, I found myself Googling around trying to find out more about the flapping and whatnot they used. I found that pretty amazing, you know, how they used cables and ropes to hold the boats together. And, you know, that's kind of fascinating and I think useful historical information. And then the use of the word vessels and how they're applied in other parts of Scripture, I think, you know, you can always make use of the scriptures in that way to give more historical context to other scriptures that are more doctrinal, you know. And I think that's what you did tonight, you know, in the use of the word vessel and so on and so forth. And I think that's something to remember because as I often say, you know, Christians in our day need to be on a journey. you know, we need to be on a journey because Tank has been pretty much hunkered down for the 5 years of its existence, primarily hunkered down on justification. And again, because the Protestantism has been about nothing but justification, I mean, necessarily nothing about justification and salvation, because that's what it's predicated on. So obviously the only thing that's been focused on for 500 years is justification. Hence, we know really very little about living godly, spirit-powered lives, okay, and the wisdom thereof. And an example of that is the article that you pointed to about grieving, okay? And I was actually had seen that article and was in the midst of writing an article about it this morning and ran into an emergency and had to put it on hold. But I'm actually at 6 o'clock in the morning, I was writing an article on that article. And as you stated, the article on grieving was from a secular perspective, more or less, but Johnny readily also saw the scriptural parallels in what the guy was saying. You know, grieving is just, you know, what you do. Now, he said other things that I'm going to examine a little bit more closely, but I think that I'm not inclined to disagree with him that as far as grief, it is something you carry until God brings this situation with the world to an end, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I think ultimately our tears get wiped away in the end, but not mm-hmm. necessarily during this life. And mm-hmm. of course, you know, that's not what we're taught. Is more and more as we get contemporarily closer to the authentic article, it's this rejoicing in evil because, it, you know, suffering is an actual epistemology, you know, mm-hmm. As we've been learning in the Heidelberg Disputation. So, you know, it should be exciting. It should be exciting to know that we're on a whole new journey where we're learning together, and of course people are afraid of that. But I personally, I feel so much freedom in just saying, you know, as far as powerful godly living, it's wide open territory. Okay, and you know, we have a lot to learn, and I think that article was indicative of that. The guy challenged all of these truisms that we hear about grief and suffering all the time. Well, it's mm-hmm. God's will, you know. You know, well, is it? You know. So what I'm saying is all of these things have to be rethought. You know, all these things have to be rethought. So, you know, everything's been about justification for 500 years, and that wasn't even right. Because that wasn't right, neither was Christian living right. And mm-hmm. As you know, easily perceived by anybody who follows the news. So, anyway, that is kind of a rabbit track to what we were talking about, but it is what it is.
Great comment, Paul. Your input is invaluable here. But thank you so much for all your comments and everything that you were able to add to that tonight. We will go ahead then, and we'll let you go and give our best to Susan when we talk to her.
I will, and as far as I know, she's out in Xenia listening. We got a lot of craziness going on in our life, and I'll let you go, my friend. Thanks for the lesson tonight. It's given me some different perspectives on you know, ways we should be studying the Word of God, and that needs to be developed in the laity. The science of studying the Word of God is something that drastically needs to be developed in the laity, and basically you've given me some different perspectives on that tonight and some great ideas, so I appreciate it.
Great. All right, thanks, Paul. You have a great evening. We'll talk to you soon.
All right. See you later. Bye-bye now.
All right, bye-bye. All right, and with that, we will bring our lesson for tonight to a close. Thank you once again, everyone, for being part of the program tonight. For those of you who listen live or on your own later on, hopefully the lesson was a blessing to you tonight. Even though it was full for me, it was a blessing to be able to do this study and to be able to have a heart and bring it to you, knowing that it's an encouragement to me, knowing that it can be a help and an encouragement to someone out there. I ask and invite you to join us once again next Thursday, 7 o'clock, for our next lesson, Lesson 65. And we are coming to a close on our study of the Book of Acts. So, from the Potter's House, Tank Industries, this is your host, Andy Young. Wish you all good night, and we will see you again next week. Thank you for joining us.